Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm Will Arimus.
And I'm April Glazer.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America.
On today's show, we'll be joined by Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, a professor of political science and policy at George Mason University and a global fellow of the Latin American program at the Wilson Center, where she studies security at the U.S.-Mexico border. Horrific stories have flooded the news and social media in recent weeks about the Trump administration's former policy to separate families at the border and how that's led to more than 2,000 children being taken from their parents. Now whole families are being detained. Much has been discussed around the private facilities where individuals, including minors who cross the border, are housed, which includes large tents and makeshift cages inside of warehouses.
We'll discuss another private industry that's working with the government to carry out its immigration policies, the tech industry. We'll look at the billion-dollar contracts that have been awarded to build a so-called virtual border wall between Mexico and the United States, and what such a wall might look like. We also have a second interview for you on today's show. We'll be joined later by Brian Brackeen, CEO of a face recognition company called Kairos. Kairos provides face recognition technology to businesses, but Brackeen warns that putting the same kind of software and data in the hands of law enforcement is a very bad idea. We'll ask him why that is and what he sees as the more appropriate uses for a controversial cutting-edge technology. All right, welcome to the show. We have a special episode this week. In lieu of our normal discussion of the week's news, we have a pair of interviews with expert guests on related themes.
Our interview with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera was recorded on June 26th, and our interview with Brian Brackeen was recorded on July 3rd. We've combined both of these interviews about the ever-changing landscape of digital surveillance into one show for y'all.
So without further ado, here's our first guest.
Our guest today is Dr. Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, a professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and a global fellow of the Latin American program at the Wilson Center. Her areas of expertise are U.S.-Mexico relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking across the U.S.-Mexico border. Her newest book, which came out last year, is titled Los Zetas Incorporated, Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. Dr. Correa Cabrera, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to start with a little background on my question. While Trump is still pushing for his border wall amidst the immigration crisis, the humanitarian emergency that's happening right now, for decades, the U.S. has actually dreamed of and tried to build a kind of virtual wall at the border. There was a multi-billion-dollar contract with Boeing in 2006 to build 1,800 towers along the Mexican and Canadian borders. This was part of the Secure Border Initiative. That contract was canned, I believe, in 2011 for being unsuccessful. In 2014, Arizona Border Surveillance Technology Plan was issued. The Israeli company Elbit was commissioned to build a network of surveillance towers. I think for like $145 million, 43 towers were built, Bloomberg reported, by that initiative. There's 12,000 underground motion sensors, as well as an array of high-definition cameras, predator drones, blimps, towers, stretching across the 2,000 miles of land that make up the U.S.-Mexico border. I guess I'm just curious, why do we need all of this tech? I mean, we have, I think, something like 20,000 people working for Border Patrol, guarding the border. What is this tech trying to solve?
It's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. It's very difficult to completely close the border, to shut the border. It's almost impossible for many reasons. Of course, there's an allegation that more surveillance and virtual and material walls and all this technology will solve the problem, and that would help the customs and border protection to prevent more people from crossing the border and drugs and all that. But in reality, we have to ask who's benefiting from this technology, these, you know, walls that are going to be built, because, you know, as we have known, the number of Border Patrol agents has doubled in the past few years, and also the technology that has been put to protect certain parts of the border, and people are still arriving. And smugglers are getting much more, you know, creative, and people don't necessarily need to cross through the border, right? They can do it by sea, they can do it by tunnels, or they can do it through corrupt networks on both sides of the border. So I am not sure how much this is going to help to prevent people from crossing the border. But and on the other, I mean, there's another thing that we need to consider, mm-hmm. that the number of apprehensions in the last few years, in the last decades, have been decreasing. It's interesting that the perception, or at least the discourse of the current administration, is that we need to protect the border. People are, this is a mess. I lived at the border for 8 years, and that was not a crisis. We didn't have a migration crisis as the crisis that it's perceived in Washington. So to respond to your question, I am not sure why we really need this. If we want to prevent people from coming, it's more, you know, we would save a lot of money addressing the roots of the problem. And all this money is going to be benefiting the contractors more than anybody else.
So April mentioned a few of the technologies that are being used on the border. What are you aware of in terms of the role that tech is playing right now in the border policy of the United States?
Well, tech is playing an important role. We see like the number of drones have increased. Of course, the fence includes cameras and includes technology to prevent people from crossing, or helping the Border Patrol to do their work through the installation of cameras, mainly, right? This is added to the fence. Also another type of technology that we need to consider is all these systems that are utilized to conduct the surveillance of the people that are crossing each day the border, right? All the fingerprints, the way to identify the different people that are crossing through the formal checkpoints.
And so I want to talk about that, because you said that, you know, you're talking about the people that live on the border. What does this, you know, surveillance mean for the communities that live there? I mean, are they essentially in a surveillance state? Because it seems like you said there's you know, no real way to really stop people from crossing, even with a lot of surveillance. So, you know, what is it like for the people that have to live with that?
That's a very important question. And this is what we have to consider as well. Border communities, people who live at the border, are not going to be able to have their privacy. You know, the right to privacy is not going to be respected. If these cameras, if all this technology is utilized to see who's coming, this is going to be utilized as a way to, to see what the people are, you know, who are living there, what are they doing? This is a very big problem for the communities who live there, for the people. The people are going to be watched all the time. They will not be able to conduct their normal activities, to do their work in privacy. And that's a fundamental right that's going to be violated by all this surveillance. And this is something that we really need to consider. What kind of country we want to have, what kind of country the United States is going to become with all this surveillance, allegedly to protect the country from people and drugs from coming. It's going to be also going to affect the citizens of the United States who live at the border, and the communities are not small.
Right. And Representative Hurd from Texas has been saying, you know, pushing for a virtual wall, right? Which we talked about at the beginning, and instead of, you know, President Trump's, or maybe in addition to, or instead of Trump's, you know, actual wall that he's trying to build. But that would probably just mean, you know, even more surveillance for those border communities. Do you know anything about where this data goes once it's collected? Is it owned by Department of Homeland Security?
Yes, this is what I understand, that the Department of Homeland Security finally is the one that, I mean, this is the institution that's managing all this information. There is also inter-institutional cooperation, and probably definitely other agencies are going to cooperate. The DEA, the FBI, I mean, the Department of Justice is going to play a role here. We're not talking only about immigration, but we also talk about drugs and arms. Mm-hmm. We're talking about different devices, right? So it's kind of difficult to... with a lot of detail to say who's going to manage what, but this information needs to be shared among the agencies. Even like, for example, the National Guard is going to be used, and it has been utilized to supposedly protect the border from immigrants from coming. So, I mean, we have also the Defense Department being involved to some extent. So this information is going to be shared.
Right. But then, you know, once you have this kind of dragnet surveillance or surveillance over an entire area, you're going to be collecting data on people that did nothing wrong, like people that just live at the border. And then that data, you know, could be held by Department of Homeland Security, like in a fusion center, and could be accessed by local police departments. And once you have a database of people, whether or not they did anything wrong or not, they're much more susceptible to being, you know, profiled by police in the future or something like that. It seems like it can kind of create a cycle of criminality for people that did nothing wrong, that just live at the border.
That's exactly right. And I forgot to say, I mean, forgot to mention not only interagency, but among the different levels of government, right? Local police are going to be able to access that information. And this is mainly my concern with all this technology, with all this surveillance that's going to be conducted at the border. It's going to be really affecting the privacy rights of border communities, of the people who live at the border.
It seems like this is always going to be kind of a game of cat and mouse, right? So as soon as you build the surveillance technology, I'm sure people who are crossing the border will find a way to circumvent it, right? This is what they do. And so then you have to build it again or reinstall it again. And it just seems like it's an unending pile-on or snowball of spending when it comes to securing the border.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's what I wanted to say in the beginning. And the question is, who are you going to benefit in the end? These companies that are going to be winning the contracts, and what is going to be like the real benefit of building the wall, or what it's going to be doing, right? And the United States already has a problem with undocumented immigration already in the country. And yes, we mentioned it can be tunnels or where people can circumvent all this technology in different ways. I mean, they can come by sea now. If people are provided with a job once they enter the United States, they're going to continue entering. There are pull factors that are very, very relevant. One is the biggest pull factor is represented by the jobs that are offered to these people, right? So if you really want to address this issue, we have probably to address this issue through the demand for labor, right? Not for the supply of labor from that side, and criminalize, you know, these people, and spend a lot of money that's going to benefit only a few companies. That's where these things don't make a lot of sense to me, and the rhetoric is very, you know, it's going to promote an inequality and the benefit only of a bunch of corporate groups.
Are there any upsides to the use of technology that you see? I mean, are there any technologies that you've heard of proposed for use along the border in some way that you are actually hopeful about or see any reason for optimism?
Well, this is also a very difficult question. As I mentioned, it's to be technology that's not so expensive and would serve the purposes. The utilization of drones with cameras probably, you know, would not affect so much, but it's also costly, right? I think that the conditions in the countries of origin need to change. And there need to be a commitment and an agreement between the countries of Mexico, Central America, the United States, a commitment, a compromise, and the conditions in the countries need to be addressed. Also, with regards to the labor market in the United States, if you want to address this issue, you don't have to do it with technology, but maybe, you know, unmanned airplanes and, yeah, probably some technology. But at the same time, we have already talked about the ineffectiveness in the end if you don't address the root causes of these issues, right? So, well, it's difficult to say what is the technology that's going to be better, right? That we need to leave it to the engineers that are working with Donald Trump and with the current administration and that have been working in the past administrations, not only, you know, this administration, but let's consider that during the Obama years and the Bush years, this has been growing exponentially, and this is not a new era. This is just a continuation of an era of technology, of fencing, of contractors that are getting better reach because of all this.
Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, thanks so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. It was a pleasure to be with you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have our interview with Brian Brackeen, CEO of Kairos, which is a facial recognition company. We talked to him about the future of the technology and his critique of how it's used in law enforcement.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our guest today is Brian Brackeen. He's the CEO of Kairos, a Miami-based artificial intelligence company specializing in face recognition. Before founding Kairos, Brian worked as a senior project manager for Apple, and before that, at IBM. In addition to his work at Kairos, Brian lectures around the world on entrepreneurship, code, the digital economy, and he participates in mentorship programs for organizations like Girls Who Code, Black Girls Code, and the School District of Miami. Brian recently wrote an op-ed for the tech site TechCrunch that was widely shared in tech circles. The headline was, "Facial Recognition Software is Not Ready for Use by Law Enforcement." Brian, welcome to If Then.
Thanks for having me here.
All right, so I want to get into this op-ed you wrote, but first, can you just tell us briefly what exactly face recognition is and how it works?
Face recognition is a newer technology that allows computers to see and understand people around them. So just like you and me when we were kids, we're born not knowing anyone, and then as time goes on, we learn who our parents are, who our sisters and brothers are, who our friends are. Facial recognition works the exact same way, but at scale. It can find one person in millions in just milliseconds.
All right. And in order to do that, it needs to collect lots of data on people's faces, right? So it can pick out the identifying patterns in their facial features and then find a match when it sees them again?
Exactly correct. And just like people, the more people it sees, the more it learns. Some of the algorithms have only been trained on certain sets of people or certain groups, and therefore it doesn't know as much about other groups of people, women, minorities, you name it.
Right. And so we've seen this demonstrated in various circumstances where facial recognition software is very good at identifying a white face. But when it comes to people with different skin color, that's not as light. They haven't been as successful at finding a correct match. Right.
That is exactly correct. What happens is these things are born in university. And oftentimes, particularly in America, universities are of much larger white populations than the general public. And so it gets used to seeing, you know, white males, particularly in university and has a hard time identifying other folks in the real world.
All right. So can you tell us why you make the argument that face recognition technology is not ready for use by law enforcement? Obviously, you're in the business of using face recognition technology, but why is it that you think it could be particularly problematic for police to use it or for surveillance agencies to use it?
Or is particularly problematic because they already are using it. So
both are true. So, yeah, one of the concerns we have is it's kind of equal treatment across groups. So I'll start by saying, you know, we love facial recognition. That's what we do for a living. We use it for business use cases, things like cruise lines, things like theme parks, things like blockchain transactions. When Kairos may be wrong about someone, it means maybe they don't see their picture on a cruise, or it means maybe they are asked a second time to log into their phone. When law enforcement gets it wrong, we're talking about people's, you know, lives, their civil liberties, their freedoms, even their life is at stake. And when you have a situation where certain groups have a more likely chance to either be false positively selected or false negatively selected, you've got a real issue there. The analogy I like to give is, let's say you had tasers for a police department. It would be patently ridiculous for me to say, okay, for this tool, the taser, it works really, really well on this group of folks, but it doesn't work really well on this group of folks, right? We wouldn't accept that. And so I don't know why we would accept facial recognition not working for different groups in police and law enforcement as well.
If the data were better and if the technology worked equally well on all different groups of people, would you then support the use of face recognition technology by law enforcement agencies? And I want to back that question up with a specific example. Recently, there was the shooting in a newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland, and police actually are said to have used a face recognition database that Maryland has at the state level to quickly identify the suspect in that shooting. That would seem to people like a good thing, but what do you think? I mean, is there potential for use of face recognition tech by law enforcement, or do you think it's never going to be a good idea?
I'm definitely a glass half full person, so I hope that it will be a good idea in the future when the system works equally across everyone. I'd be all for some of these use cases. It won't be right for Kairos, but it will be right for others, and I totally accept that. I don't think that reality exists right now. And there's also a lack of regulation to make sure there's oversight as well in some of these systems. The example you gave in Maryland, which is super tragic, and obviously what we would all consider a good use of facial recognition, but it's all in how you phrase it. If you said to folks, hey, we're going to use facial recognition to find this one bad guy, absolutely, sounds good. If you also said to folks, hey, we're going to comb through every driver's license photo you've ever taken to try to find a bad guy, then maybe they wouldn't feel the same way. Both of those things are true. And I think we need to just, as a society, come to grips with that, consider it, have legislation around it, and then it'll be fine.
It's not just, though, about whether or not it works. Well, you mentioned that we need to have good regulation around these technologies, because you mentioned in your op-ed that this technology could also be used to violate privacy. So, for instance, if people are exercising their First Amendment rights at a protest, and they are certainly allowed to do so, you know, law enforcement can use this technology broadly to identify people who aren't doing anything wrong and have no reason to stoke suspicions of law enforcement, and yet are, you know, searched for it as if they are a suspicious character. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and we see this already in other countries that don't have the same kind of civil liberties and protections that we do in America. So we've heard of the Iranians and the Chinese using these tools to figure out who are the folks at pro-democracy rallies. We've also seen China using it to make sure that certain ethnic minorities, Muslim minorities, stay in one part of the country and don't leave and go to other parts of the country. And when anyone from that town goes to different parts of the country, the cameras quickly alert the police. They're grabbed and moved back to that one town. So these are things that here in the U.S. we certainly wouldn't accept. And these are the kind of slippery slope that we're trying to keep from happening.
Now, one thing that I'm very aware of is that if data is being collected by a corporation, there is not a small chance that the government might somehow try to access that data. And so, you know, whether or not we're opposed to government use of this technology, it seems like it's going to be hard to avoid potential civil liberties violations if the technology just exists in the world. And I want to get into the corporate uses a bit in this in a second, but what are your thoughts on just kind of the databases or the fact that, you know, if corporations use it, then governments might also tap it?
Yeah. So in our case, in Facebook's case, in any kind of private company's case, the government can send something called a national security letter, which says we're looking for information about this particular individual. What I think is, I guess, a little bit less concerning about that is there is now, for whatever reason, you would assume probable cause, you would hope. There's also an opportunity, though it's a closed proceeding, to fight that national security letter and then go see a FISA court or a secret court. And there's some due process there.
Right.
In the other example, in the police example, you simply already have all the driver's license information. You have all the driver's license photos, all the passport photos. You could put a camera right on, you know, Main Street in any town, and you could track anyone in the entire town that way. We feel like that's inappropriate.
Retail shops are already using facial recognition technology to find repeat customers and identify shoplifters. You know, the FBI already has a facial recognition database that's said to, you know, have access to more than 400 million images. You know, you might have seen the study from Georgetown Law last year that said about half of all American adults are in at least one law enforcement database. It seems like, yes, there are a lot of ways this can go wrong. Is there any way to walk back, though, the fact that we are already see this technology being used in such a full way? It seems like it's already out there. It's going to be hard to go back and rectify this. And then on top of that, sorry to layer the question, but how would we be able to go back? What would you recommend we do?
Well, the baby has definitely been born. I think the pregnancy is definitely over on facial recognition or on artificial intelligence. But that doesn't mean that it's too late to do some things. One of the major issues we have is the could versus should world. A lot of these researchers that are doing this kind of work, they come from university and they get A's based on, can you do something? If you can push the limits, how far can you go? And unfortunately, they bring that mentality into the workplace, again, at the Microsofts, at the Amazons of the world, you name it. We need to start asking ourselves if we should do certain things. And there are still so few facial recognition companies, both commercially and in the government space, that we can have a kind of communal conversation and create some standards here. We're actually looking to sign on to some opt-in regulation ourselves about things that we're not going to want to do or won't be able to do. Folks who won't sell it to, we won't allow our technology to be used for lethal uses, for instance. So I think as this conversation is evolving, we're going to find some ways that we can all get on the same page.
Could you give us some examples of applications beyond unlocking your phone or kind of entertainment on a cruise ship that we might use facial recognition technology, again, and also not by law enforcement?
Sure. The obvious and most common one is Apple's flagship iPhone 10. You know, you use it to unlock your phone, but it's being used a variety of different ways as well. So there's one thing called anonymous facial recognition. This is facial recognition that doesn't know who you are, but knows other things about you, your age, gender, ethnicity, maybe even the emotions that you're feeling. These use cases include retailers. There'll be a camera in the front of the retail store. They want to understand the demographics of the folks that are coming in to see if their advertising is matching actual traffic flow. You see this amongst the movie studios. So they will show people a film. They'll pay them to watch a film. And they'll have cameras in the front reading their emotions of the people as they watch the film to figure out the highs, the lows. Wow. Women didn't like this joke. Men didn't like that or what have you. So there's a variety of anonymous facial recognition use cases. And then there's, matching facial recognition use cases. Like in our case, there's been a huge problem with cryptocurrency and blockchain and theft. We make sure that the person that is accepting or sending the funds really is the person that it's supposed to be. All these use cases in banking and finance and blockchain are also really good examples of facial recognition.
So obviously you run your company in a way that's very concerned with ethics. And you say on your company's website, unlike many face recognition companies today, we don't chase profits at the expense of human rights. You're out there advocating for better legislation. But do you ever worry that just by participating in the face recognition industry, by helping to build these databases, that you might be contributing to that future that you are concerned about, where none of us can walk down the street without the feeling that we're being watched or surveilled by this type of software?
Yeah, and that's the difference between the government versus non-government use case. In our case, and in our customers' cases, we have to have a relationship with the person, with the customer. We've got to sign up for something. We've got to have your photo. Retailers don't know who everyone is until they decide to give them their information. And again, in the government's case, they pretty much know who everyone is as a part of their kind of mandate, right? And so as long as you stay on the kind of non-government side, you can live in a non-Orwellian world, but the more work you do in the government side, or companies that merge the two, are starting to work in that kind of Orwellian future, and we're trying to fight against that.
Brian Brackeen, thank you so much for joining us on If Then.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hi. You can follow me and Will on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser, and Will is at Will Oremus.
Thanks again to Brian Brackeen. You can follow him on Twitter at Brian Brackeen. That's B-R-A-C-K-E-E-N. And thanks also to Guadalupe Correa Cabrera. You can follow her on Twitter at G Correa Cabrera.
Thanks to everyone who has left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. It's a big part of promoting our show, and we deeply appreciate it.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs. Thanks to Don Aulis at A Room with a VU in Santa Barbara.
Thanks to Danielle Hewitt here in Slate Studios in D.C. Also, thanks to Robert Kirby at Fantasy Studios in Berkeley.
We'll see you next week.